when you study Chumash, you have to develop a certain type of a sensitivity to nuances, to words. It's got its own style. All of those literary critics that try to, that think they understand the style and they make certain decisions that someone, it wasn't written by God or whatever it is on the basis of style, to me, it's pretty much nonsense. I don't see any comparison between the style of the Chumash and any other literary style that I'm familiar with. It's got a style of its own. And with gaps, very, very difficult constructions in the wording sometimes, just trying to figure out what's being said. And then, of course, generally speaking, you wish there'd be more information. You'd like, it doesn't correspond to history the way we'd write a history or biography. It gives you little tidbits. As I said, I gave a class about the Moshe Rabbeinu the other night. You really don't get a sense that you know any of these people. All the people that we read about. And that's an important aspect of Chumash, to learn about great people. Avraham and Sarah, the patriarchs and matriarchs, etc. And the 12 sons of Yaakov, they're important. Yosef gives you the most about Yosef or Yehuda. Do you really know these people? Moshe Rabbeinu. You don't get to know them at all. It's not like you read a biography if it's with a lot of detail and how the person felt about things, what the person said, how they reacted to various situations, what they went through, their struggles. If it's good, you walk away with a certain feeling, like you know this person. Chumash does not provide that at all. So it's very unique. And what it chooses to give us, what it leaves out, much more than it includes. So therefore, you have to develop a certain sense of the style, to whatever extent it's, you're capable of doing it, because you have to ask questions. And then sometimes it gives you information which seems very trivial. Like, well, why is it giving us this? And that becomes a bit... All of these questions give you an opportunity to probe a little deeper. Because it's hard to pierce through. You're just reading a story. And how do you pierce through and work your way into the deeper issues? So I want to do that today. And it's a special kind of reading that you have to engage in. You read the Chumash, you're reading it differently than you would read any other book. That's why you got to keep rereading and rereading it. And a lot of times when you reread it, you'll just notice a certain nuance that you didn't notice many, many times before. It jumps out at you. Now, we're dealing with the encounter between Moshe and Paro. We did the initial stages, we did the burning bush, and Moshe's initial meeting with Paro, which we said ended in a disaster, made things worse for the Jews. And Moshe was obviously bothered, embittered, whatever term you want to use. There too, it's hard to say. And I think it's, unless it's clear that Moshe got angry or something like that, to say that he was so upset when the Nogsim, when the officers encountered it, they left Paro, they went to Paro to protest, and Paro laid down the law for them, that it's because you're lazy and this whole religious business is nonsense. Then they meet Moshe and they really give it to Moshe. That you could say, they really, there was anger there in the way they spoke to Moshe. That's clear. And then Moshe goes back to God and says, why did you make things worse for them? And why did you send me? And since you sent me, things got worse and you haven't saved the nation. The tonality over there is not so clear. It does seem, one could say it's a complaint, it's a protest. It's a question. But I wouldn't use words like angry and things like that. You've got to be very, very careful. Now, we shouldn't be projecting our own reactions onto Moshe. You've got to sort of differentiate. A lot of times, a person's interpretation of something in the Chumash is much more reflective of his own psychology than what's going on over there. That's a pitfall that people fall into. You have to develop a certain understanding of appropriate technique and to be objective, ask the right questions, know where to go to for answers, and so forth. Then in Va'era, God speaks to Moshe, and he's It seems that it's a second message. We're going to be taking that up. We haven't taken it up in detail yet. What is new about the second message? And the whole idea that I appeared to the patriarchs with the name Kael Shakai, but in my name, with my name Hashem, I didn't make myself known to them. And then further, the four languages of redemption. A message to the Jewish people about the redemption. Which it would seem that Moshe had already delivered that same basic message, not in such detail. We'll take that up. And then you have Moshe's protest that he has a defect, a speech defect. How do you expect Paro to listen to me when the Jews wouldn't listen to me? And then God charges him. God charges him and Aharon, officially. Then you have the official designation in a permanent kind of way that when they go to Paro, because that was the complaint of Moshe, apparently, that in spite of the fact that God had brought Aharon together with him to speak for him, but it doesn't mean that he would speak on every occasion. And it would seem, according to the Ramban, that God did not intend for Moshe, that at the first meeting with Paro, Moshe spoke. Paro did not. And the reason he gives is because it would be construed as disrespectful. If you're going to a king and you're too important, I don't talk directly to you. If Moshe would have been standoffish in that way, he doesn't speak, this is my spokesman, that would have appeared to be haughty and disrespectful of the king. So, at least at the first meeting, Moshe had to speak. And thus, Moshe apparently attributed the failure to a certain extent to his, that was his point all along, he's not a good communicator. And thus he returns to that theme over here. But according to the Ramban, God now charged Moshe and Aaron to speak to Paro. It makes perfect sense. It fits in very nicely with the Pesukim. If you take a look at Shemos in Vo'era, at the end of chapter 6, the beginning of chapter 7, where God says to Moshe, I am the Lord, I am Hashem. Speak to Paro, the king of Egypt, everything that I will say to you. So apparently at this point in time, to understand what's going on, God is commanding Moshe to speak to Paro, apparently to speak directly to Paro, speech impediment and all. And it would seem then that the role of Aaron did not have to do with Paro. The role of Aaron was limited to the dealings with the Jewish people. So that makes sense in Pasuk Lamed. The next part, Moshe said before God, behold, I have uncircumcised lips. That was the expression to denote the impediment. And how will Paro listen to me? I think the expression of Aral Sfasayim over here, uncircumcised, indicates more of the practical. Obviously, he had some kind of a practical defect in terms of his ability to speak. And it would seem that untrained as well. That wasn't his area. There's two things. There's the technical ability to speak, and then there's a certain smoothness. Certain people have a flair for rhetoric, for speaking. They like that. And they come across in the right way. So Moshe was, it seems, unlearned in the whole area. The whole area was not appealing to him. We had made the point that while it's true that most leaders do possess the gift of speech, that seems to be one of the most important requirements, nevertheless, it has a downside, and ultimately, the highest form of leadership is where people are led by the ideas. And to the extent that a certain charisma influences people, that takes away from the ultimate objective. Then people are not following the idea, they're following the charisma of the person. That's a lower level of leadership. And the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu, that was the highest form of leadership, where the leadership would not be based upon the charisma of the person, but it would be based upon the clarity of the ideas. Now, in chapter 7, we see a change in the plan. It would seem, this seems to be a response to Moshe's complaint. God said to Moshe, see, I have made you as a god, so to speak, unto Paro. That is, the way God is establishing the situation. And your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You're going to be in that role, so to speak. Now, obviously, he's not a god, and he did not seek to convince Paro that he is a god. That would be a false reading. The purpose was not to make Paro think that Moshe was a god. That would be absurd. However, in terms of the way in which they would relate, that is, you're going to be connected with God. You will speak everything that I command you. Moshe, but he won't speak to Paro. So Moshe will be the one who communicates with God and has the message from God. And Aaron, your brother, will speak to Paro that he should send out the Jews from his land. So now we have a new situation, that both of them have been charged to go back to Paro. Then, of course, as we said, God tells them that I'm going to harden the heart of Paro, and I will increase my signs, and he won't listen to you. So God is telling this to Moshe at the outset. Of course, we could see the significance. It's not difficult to see the significance of that. As we said, Moshe Rabbeinu is a human being. He's going to carry out the mission, and he's going to be affected by the results. So if things are not working out, he's going to wonder why not. He's going to blame himself. So God is telling him in advance, don't get upset. He's not going to listen to you. More than that, I'm going to harden his heart. As we mentioned, we'll be coming back to the issue of the hardening of the heart. But here God is giving him more information, that Egypt will know that I am the Lord when I stretch forth my hand over Egypt and I take out the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, from amongst them. And it says that Moshe and Aaron did as God commanded them. Thus they did. We mentioned last week, as the commentator, I believe it's the Sforno, says, that pasuk is not superfluous. It would seem superfluous. What's it telling me? That Moshe and Aaron did what God commanded, as opposed to what? What do I expect? That they didn't listen to God and they did their own thing? Doesn't make sense. But the point is, as we explained, it's telling us that they did not introduce any changes. And that's a very big challenge for anybody in a position of leadership. There's always a tremendous amount of pressure to make certain changes, as opposed to following the absolute principle, whether it's a halachic principle, whether it's a moral principle. People in a position of leadership are always under the pressure of the masses, of other people, to make changes, and very often it just seems to make sense in order to, so something should work. And this is a tremendous pressure. It should not be underestimated. It's a tremendous pressure on leaders. Many great leaders have fallen because of this. I guess you might call it the need of the approval or the fear of the disapproval. And under that pressure, people are really tempted to make certain kinds of changes. Let's put it that way. I'm sure you all have an example of it in your own life. You don't have to be a leader to, within your family, you want to do something, or even the case we've just been describing, somebody, some friends, some family members getting married, but the marriage is prohibited because they're marrying a non-Jew, and there's a tremendous family pressure just to go along with it. You don't have to participate too much. There's always pressures from other people, and that fear that they're not going to like me. They're not going to like me. We should not underestimate that. That's something that a person should think about and develop some kind of a strategy for dealing with it. Now, in this situation, the stakes are very, very high. You're not dealing with a simple situation of a family or a friend. You're dealing with the people that you're leading. So, and you care about them, and you want to help them. You don't want to hurt them. There will always be temptations to introduce certain changes that, according to the way it seems to you that things are unfolding. It's not going right. And that takes a tremendous discipline to be absolutely committed to the nevuah, to the prophecy, to be doing it the correct way in spite of the fact that, to all intents and purposes, it doesn't seem to be the right thing to do. It doesn't seem, because we have a limited perspective. Now, let's go on to the next thing. I want to take up today the second incident between Moshe and Paro. The first one, as we said, didn't go too well for the Jews. Now, the second encounter. Bear in mind, the first time around, Moshe did not produce any demonstrations, any miracles, any evidence. He just spoke to Paro. What seemed was a very abstract thing about God, God exists, and God communicates with us, and God wants us to do certain actions, that we have to serve God, we have to bring sacrifices to God, and if not, we'll suffer the consequences. That's what he said, pen yifkeinu, lest God afflict us with punishments if we don't. But that's all. He didn't do anything more than just talk to Paro. Apparently, there was the possibility that he could convince him. All the Mefarshim hold that Paro was a highly intelligent individual. The Torah is not talking about some fool. That would be obviously a complete waste of time. But he was a significant individual and very intelligent, very educated. Apparently, he was capable of hearing the ideas. But of course, he was also a very stubborn person. All right, so first you start with persuasion. The higher the level of the individual, the more he operates in accordance with truth, with ideas. There's no need for you to... If you're telling me to do something which makes a lot of sense and I'm resisting, an intelligent person, I don't have to ask you for a sign that you're right. Give me a sign. I won't even give you a sign. Listen to the ideas. Let's deal on an intellectual level. If you're trying to convince someone that they need to go to a doctor because they have certain symptoms that could be dangerous, and you give all the rational reasons, and they're resistant. And they'll say, well, give me a sign that you're right. That would be absurd. Now, what kind of sign? Use your head. Operate according to logic. But Paro failed the logic test. So God now tells Moshe, when you speak to Paro, when Paro speaks to you, rather, thus there's the implication over here that Paro would be, even though the Torah doesn't describe it, because where do we see that Paro is going to request a sign from you? Paro pretty much threw you out. He just dismissed you and made things worse. So, to all intents and purposes, it seems that Paro is not interested in any further discussion. Nevertheless, over here God says, when Paro asks, he says, give me a sign. So God is telling him that Paro is going to ask for a sign. I'm just going to state it as a question. I do believe the Ramban talks about this. That one could ask a question. God is saying when Paro asks for a sign, this is what you should do. And then Moshe goes ahead. But it doesn't describe that Paro even asked for anything. Under what circumstance? It was Moshe supposed to go back and initiate discussions and then Paro would ask? The Torah doesn't tell us that. I also want to just take note, throughout the description of the 10 plagues, this is a very important point. The wondrous things, I guess the so-called miracles, are referred to with two terms. Sometimes they're called mophase, a sign, and sometimes they're called os, which is a sign. So is there any difference? It's just interchangeable terms, and sometimes the Chumash is using one. Osu mofe. Sometimes they're both used. So clearly, if they're both being used, they can't be substitutes. Each one must have its own signification. I'd like to address that right now with the help of the Sforno. Now, the Sforno on Tess, on 9, says, the Pasuk says, Tnu lachem mofes, when Paro says, provide a sign. Sometimes it's translated as a wonder, which doesn't really help you that much. A wonder meaning something which is unusual. That's fine. But that's not going to help you in terms of knowing the difference between the two. So he says that the mophase, I'm going to use the Hebrew words, is to teach you concerning the greatness of the sender, that is God. V'sheroi lishmo b'kolo. And that it's appropriate to listen to his voice. So, the mophase is a demonstration which is only intended to affirm the existence, the power of God, the control of God, the authority of God, and that one is bound to follow God. That was one idea. If you don't accept that idea, then there's no point. What's the point of the whole message? That God said do such and such. If you don't have a proper recognition of God and where you stand in relation to God, God's authority and God's power, so it's pointless. That is the mo-face. The mo-face is to demonstrate all this, the existence of God and everything associated with that. However, the oath is testimony for the messenger. So two things had to be established. And we did that in the Rambam at the very outset. Two things had to be established. A, the idea of God, the foundation of foundation, fundamental of fundamentals. Even if I accept God and everything you say, how do I know that what you're saying is true? How do I know that you're the authentic representative of God? Well, that's just as significant. Can't say it's more significant, it's just as significant. Throughout history, we've had nothing but phonies who claim to speak in the name of God. Today, the whole world is in a state of confusion. Who is the authentic spokespeople for God? Is it the Jews? Is it the Christians? Is it the Muslims? And you can name all the others. Now, the Sforno says, therefore, he did the osos before. Now, how does he know this? Because when describing the signs that Moshe did before the Jews, the term osos, is used. Now, the reason is because they did not have any doubt as to the greatness of the sender and his power. That is, the Jews, the elders of the Jews, etc., they knew about God. They didn't deny God. They didn't doubt God. So there was no need to prove to them the existence of God and his power. But what they needed to know is, who are you? Moshe only had to demonstrate his own authenticity as a prophet of God. However, Paro was in doubt about the sender. Or he denied it. He's giving two. Either he simply was in doubt, wasn't sure, or he wasn't in doubt, and he was actually in a state of denial about God's existence. As he said, Lo yadati yasad Hashem, I don't know God. Who is God that I should listen to him? I don't know God. He requested a mo-face. He requested a sign or a demonstration to verify, to establish the greatness of the sender, in a manner which would demonstrate that it is appropriate to listen to his voice. And he says it's not impossible that you could have the same thing. That's why you have osumo face, that something can be both. That the very same physical demonstration can serve. Because what he's saying is, apparently, that it's not really, there's no difference from a substantive point of view between the os and the mophase. It could be the same thing. So if that's the case, why do we have two separate terms? The terms, he says, the differentiation is purely in terms of the objective. That these phenomena occur. This is an important point. Generally speaking, these phenomena do not occur. Well, the whole world is signs and wonders. You don't need miracles. You study the laws of nature. That's a miracle. Why is that less of a miracle than what we call a miracle? That there's a system and it operates according to laws and evinces all of this infinite wisdom. So the laws of nature. However, that's the point. The point is that people are denying that there's a cause. So therefore, certain other things contrary to the laws of nature. That there's a power above and beyond that is responsible, is the source. Started the system and thus retains complete control over the system. So these things don't happen haphazardly. Miracles aren't happening all the time, except, yeah, the existence is a miracle. Today the world is fixating on miracles, the religious world. But the greatest miracle is the existence. The world exists, that it functions in accordance with a system, with the laws, and that man has a faculty within him which enables him to understand and to utilize the laws of nature and to bring about results. That's a miracle. People don't express gratitude to God if they worked something out. If a person was lazy didn't plan, messed up, and realize that they're in grave jeopardy, and they start praying to God, and miraculously it worked out, then they get all excited. But if a person planned for it and did the work and was meticulous and disciplined, and then it works out, no hum, no thank, you know, like they don't thank anyone, they don't get excited. But isn't that a miracle? That's the miracle, that you utilized your intelligence, the faculty of reason, and you applied it, and it corresponds to reality. And by acting intelligently and correctly, it worked out. You put a man on the moon. That people don't want to consider a miracle. The great people didn't need miracles. Avraham Avinu discovered God from that system. That was the miracle. He didn't need what we call a miracle. Nevertheless, we're of diminished stature. And we need so-called miracles. Because the big miracle apparently is not enough. That's a defect, I believe, in people's faith. People that are always, oh, that's a miracle, always looking for miracles all over the place. They think that they have a greater degree of faith and gratitude. In my opinion, I'm not so sure. I think it's a lesser degree. The demonstration is necessary. That's part of God's compassion to us. That in spite of the fact that he's given us enough evidence and we should see it, he does more. He deals with us in our state of weakness. However, there is a miracle over here that is not due to ignorance. That is, insofar as it substantiates the sign, substantiates the existence of the Creator, so one could perhaps be a little bit critical and say that that's a concession to human weakness. Because we're not keen enough to recognize God. However, the second function, to verify the one who speaks in the name of God, the prophet, that's not a concession to human. That's an absolute necessity. And to the contrary, that's praiseworthy. That people should not accept things on faith. People should not accept things on faith. If somebody comes to you, like all the religions of the world are based upon this false faith, which is extolled for some reason. That this person is a person of faith, so he believes. Why do you believe that Jesus is a prophet? Or Muhammad is a prophet? The whole world is aflame today with the fact they depicted Muhammad in an uncomplimentary way. I guess with bombs in some one of them. Bombs in his turban or something like that? Suggesting that there may be some connection between all the bombing in the world and their religion. The idea, you can see a connection. The idea that somebody comes to you and convinces you that he's a man of God and God speaks to him and you accept it, for you to accept it is the greatest stupidity. Without proof. There is such a thing as prophecy. However, the entire world makes a virtue of blind acceptance. You're giving up your mind. Why? This person apparently has a certain charisma. See, Moshe Rabbeinu did not have charisma. This has to be verified very, very carefully. In the absence of careful verification, you're just following this person has evoked an emotion within you. You're just following an emotion, a very misleading emotion. And that's the most important area. You could see why, in that type of a system, there is tremendous insecurity and hence tremendous aggression. All of the religions of the world are based upon aggression. Historically, that's what it's been about, torturing the non-believer. In spite of the fact that they claim, Christianity has always claimed to be the religion of love, and the Old Testament is that's the religion of justice and severe, you know, they're the people of love. What nonsense. Some love they showed throughout history. For who? What about the people that didn't believe in Jesus? Not to mention those that killed him. So Judaism maintains that believing that someone is a prophet without proof is absurd. And that's something which demands proof. That's what Moshe said to God, V'heim lo yaminu li, they will not believe me, because they will say that God did not speak to you. I know the Chazal, we do the Chazal that says that indirectly he may have been accusing the Jews of not being believers, but that's not the plain pshat. The plain pshat is, it's a praise of the Jews. The Jews are not stupid people. Stupid people believe anything they hear. Intelligent people do not believe something which is contrary to the norm. It's possible. Prophecy is possible. The burden of proof is on you. And God is not going to send someone without proof. So where's the proof? That, he says, is the second function, and the term os, a sign, refers to the phenomenon in the framework of proving the messenger of God. Given that that's the basis of the story, let's proceed now and see, does it work or not? Does it produce its desired effect? Now, in the first instance, we have the sign of the Taninim. Let's take a look. So he says, when Paro says, provide a sign, then say to Aaron, take the staff and cast it before Paro, and it will become a serpent. And Moshe and Aaron came to Paro. See, here's where we're missing something. Did they just go on their own? Because God said when Paro will demand a sign. Did Paro summon them, or did they go on their own? And Paro just received them. And maybe it's not clear from the text itself. Perhaps they went on their own. And Paro gave them an audience. And this time Paro said, give me a sign. Or perhaps Paro summoned them. We don't know. Anyways, they came to Paro, and they did what God said. And Aaron cast his staff before Paro and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Now, the reaction of Paro is very predictable. There's many, many type of midrashim to the effect that Egypt was the center of all of these different schools, you know, the occult or magical, all these different types of arts, whatever term you want to call them. So they were not unfamiliar with this type of thing. So Paro called his Khartoumim. And it said, and magicians. Apparently there were two groups, Chachamim, the wise men, and the magicians. That's an interesting statement over there. What do you see about that? What do you mean? Why these two groups? Magicians. It would seem the magicians. You want the magicians, right? What do you want the wise men for? What was the difference between the wise men and the magicians? Well, it would seem that Paro was an interesting character. He clearly was not a stupid person, and as we said, he had learning, he had knowledge and all of that, but he was not a perfected person. He was not perfected, and you'll see that. Today, there's a lot of people that are taken in by some of these occult sciences. They're not stupid people, though. They could be highly intelligent people. And they could be big leaders, world leaders. And they consult the astrology. They have these different things, superstitions, and so on and so forth. At the same time, they have their wise men, too. Because they do recognize that there is such a thing as wisdom. There is such a thing as rationality. But they're not convinced that it's the only thing. They're not convinced, and there's a certain part of them which emotionally is affected by other possibilities, by the supernatural. It's an amazing thing. You'll find many people today, even scientists, even doctors, that are caught up with the realm of the supernatural. And there's always this mishigas fad from time to time. They're always looking for that new fad, which doesn't make any rational sense. It could be crystals, the special healing power of crystals. Doctors get along. This is, I guess, borderline. They wouldn't say that this is supernatural. I would say it, though. I think it stems from the same emotion. This is popular now. I think it was more popular a few years ago. There was this trend. See, when people are desperate, they're looking for cures, like that cancer, the non-conventional cures, okay, you can experiment, whatever it is. Person is desperate, nothing to lose, so I can understand. But then there are certain things that just didn't make any sense, that if you visualize, it's all a mental thing, to the effect it's completely mental, and if you change your attitude and you visualize the cancer and visualize how you're defeating it, something like that. I don't know the exact. But any intelligent person would realize that it's pseudo-medicine. It's not true medicine. Mainstream doctors wouldn't endorse it. It doesn't make any sense. So, and then they have sometimes it's other kinds of treatments. Apricot pits. There are always some kind of mishigas. But in those kinds of things, they're going beyond the boundary lines of science. And they'll deny it, but it has to do with the supernatural. Well, you can see why this thing about the mental states is a very narcissistic thing. It's projecting all kinds of powers onto your mental state. If you think about it a certain way, that you have the power within you to cure yourself. If you look at it with a certain attitude, it's an exaggeration of it. There is a truth to the effect that there is a connection between the two, but let's not exaggerate it to that extent. By and large, a good mental state, by and large, is a good thing. Believe me, there are people with very positive mental states, the power of positive thinking, so to speak. They have wonderful attitudes, wonderful mental states, and they get stricken and they die. And there are people with terrible mental states, and they're depressed and anxiety and misery, and they get cancer and they get an operation and radiation and they get cured. It's not that simplistic a phenomenon. It means on the whole, you're right. It's healthy. The Rambam wrote about the effect between body and mind. And clearly it's a good thing, but it's not the kind of good thing the way you're going to ascribe supernatural powers to it. It doesn't work that way. That's the problem with a lot of these things in medicine. They'll isolate something, and instead of taking perspective, that factor of perspective goes out the window. That's why every few years there's a new miracle food on the market. I remember when it was oat bran. These things keep changing all the time. Do you remember when oat bran was the cure for everything? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then it's a cure for this, for that. They don't do enough experiments. They see a certain connection, and emotionally, for some reason, any food that's not pleasing to a person, that's not as enjoyable, that becomes like a cure. Coffee, I remember when caffeine, everybody, why do you have decaf now? Decaf was never, nobody would ever drink decaf. What was the point? The whole point of coffee was the caffeine, to wake you up. Coffee has a great effect upon you. I mean, most people, in the morning, you need something. That caffeine is good, and a lot of times during the day, caffeine is a good thing. I'm not saying you should get addicted, that whole other... The fact that a person needs a cup of coffee every day, I don't call that an addiction. And I don't see any reason why you should free yourself of it. You need it, and it's available. Addiction to something bad, which is harmful and destructive. Everybody needs... Some people need a glass of orange juice in the morning. Am I wrong? Truth of the matter is that everybody believes in addiction. This is a misunderstood concept. To simply say that addiction is bad and we have to avoid addiction. It depends. When we use the word addiction, we're thinking of something like a drug habit, which is a bad thing, which does destroy. But in truth, in my opinion, there's no way that you can live your life and not have quote-unquote addictions, okay? I don't know, attachments then. To me, an addiction means you're attached to something because that something is very important to you and gives you a certain pleasure. And if you don't have it, you'll have pain. So if we use the word attachment instead of addiction, I think I can prove the point, because I think all of you are, those that are not married anyways, are pursuing love. You're all pursuing love. And you're looking for that certain someone. And you really want to feel, you want to fall madly in love. But isn't that an addiction? That means you're going to be addicted to this person. You want this, but then, first of all, that period of time, you don't know how he feels about you. You're going to be in tremendous pain. And then you want to see him. And when he doesn't call, you're going to be, because you're addicted to hearing his voice. You're addicted to being with him. If he doesn't want to be with you, you're going to be miserable. If he only wants to be with you once a week, so then the other times you're going to be miserable. Why? Because you're addicted to that person. So according to you, you should never fall in love. Because once you fall in love, you have an addiction. There's no question that someone is suggesting that you put blindfold. You should, everybody should date blindfold for the first 6 months. So then, that way you know that you're really relating to the other person's soul and not to the physicality of it. Okay, that's theoretically fine. It's not going to work. I understand that. You should strive to get to know the person. But even so, that's merely saying that the relationship should not be based upon superficialities. Excellent advice. Because to the extent that it's based upon externals and images, it's going to fade away because it's not the real person. Eventually that will fade away and you'll be stuck with the real person, which is not something that can be pinned down to a look, to physical. It's the soul, essentially, that other dimension. And if the relationship is based upon the attraction and attachment to the real person, so then that love will remain, will get stronger. That people are always afraid about falling out of love. You only fall out of love, it means that you weren't in love with the person. You thought you were, but you were mistaking an accident. You fell in love with a certain image, which pretty much you created in your own mind. So there, you better be careful. You probably will fall out of love. But if the love is based upon the reality of the person, so it will only get stronger. Unless the person changes, which that's not going to, usually it doesn't happen. If you know the person, you really know the person, and you love what the person is, then yeah, unless you change, and you're not the same person, and you don't love the same things anymore. But that's the only hope, that the love will last. Okay. But after all is said and done, it doesn't matter. Once you love the person, you need that person, and not having that person is extremely painful. So to me, that's pretty much like an addiction. Point is being made that the learning, that we're supposed to cultivate a love of learning and work very hard, and ultimately one should really enjoy, get tremendous enjoyment out of learning. Well, that is true, and thus you're setting yourself up for quote-unquote addiction, because once learning is an important part of your life, just like anything else, if theoretically you couldn't partake of it anymore, it was taken away from you if you lost it. Now, you might say that that's something that's always readily available. Oh, it's true, I agree, but the point of it is that you are now vulnerable. Anytime you become very attached to something, do you not become vulnerable? That is, if it should be removed, you're going to suffer. As a way of life, it seems to me an intelligent individual is very careful about these things. Does not want to create too many attachments in the unnecessaries. The Torah speaks about the unnecessaries. And that's an important idea, the Torah's concept of wealth. One is someach b'chelka, one rejoices with one's portion. That the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim talks about this idea that we should avoid excess. And a tremendous amount of the struggling and the strife that people go through in this world, centering around increasing their whole economic situation, is to a large extent because people cannot differentiate in terms of what they truly need as opposed to the pursuing things that they don't need, but they're fantasy objects. And that's a very important idea in this coming week's parsha. That idea, pay careful attention to this week's Torah reading, because you see, one of the episodes, one of the stories in this week, B'Shalach, has to do with the whole issue of how you should live your life in terms of the economic situation. In terms of a major principle of the Torah is that man should live in accordance with need, not with excess, not with imaginary need. What is the episode, what's the story that I'm referring to? That's the story of the manna from heaven. And it's not just a situation where the Jews are hungry and God's providing food for them. There is much more significance to that. Especially you see it with regard to the man, with regard to the instruction of do not collect more than one day. The Jews were instructed, it was a training, that they should live without this idea of hoarding, without the anxiety about the future, and without the concern for more, because if a person is living according to the correct philosophy of the Torah, he will remove his anxiety about the future. And the need to spend tremendous amount of energy and effort. I mean, people are consumed by the struggle for the so-called struggle for existence. People are absolutely consumed. And with all the advances today, it hasn't diminished it one iota. If anything, people are much more consumed than ever. People work harder today in the era of wealth. There's never been a time in history when there's been such an abundance. It's absolutely amazing. This is the era of abundance. Every person today is living like a king. Couldn't even dream about. The average individual today has so much in terms of everything, in terms of shelter. The most the most elementary type of a dwelling today, electricity, hot and cold running water, the appliances in a kitchen, the basic, a refrigerator. You want to cook something, a microwave oven. So you shouldn't have to wait for the eggs to boil 15 minutes. It takes a minute, 2 minutes, you have it. You shouldn't have to wait 15 minutes. Toaster ovens, etc., television, telephone, a car, airplane. That's unbelievable. This is, you don't have to be wealthy to partake of this. You go on any airplane, you'll see plenty of people in the back, you know, whatever it is, coach. You don't have to be wealthy. The average person today is super duper wealthy. There's so much abundance. And yet, and today you have the phenomenon of people making millions. I mean, the amount of people that make big money, hundreds of thousands, millions of millions today is not even a big deal. There used to be the millionaire. A millionaire, today a millionaire is not considered a wealthy person. You got hundreds, not billionaires. And yet, in this era, people work harder than ever before in history. I'd imagine that people work harder. Isn't that funny? 500 years ago, I don't think people worked as hard as they did today. In certain, there was manual labor, there's manual labor today. Because people were limited, they couldn't. Pretty much, the work day started, I suppose, at sunrise. It had to end at sunset, when it was dark. Once night came, that was it. Business stopped. Whatever you did by daylight. You worked in the field, you were a trader, you had a craft, whatever it is. And then the day was over and people went home. And they couldn't work until the next day. Today, the night has been turned into day and people can't stop. People are working 24 hours a day. They continue working, they're on internet, and they do more deals, and they have meetings and business and social gatherings, which have to do with work. Because there's nothing to stop you. But why? You have so much, you have more than ever, and people can't stop. There's no external limitations. And it's based upon this idea that people make a tremendous mistake in this area. The inability to differentiate between the real needs of a person and the inability to recognize what constitutes wealth. They imagine that wealth is measured in purely accidental terms. Of how much? Your bank account. Which is an absurdity. Because it turns out that people spend their entire life slaving to acquire things which they don't need and will not use. The bulk of that fortune which came about through their labor will not be spent by them. They can't spend it. It's an impossibility. It's another irony that most of the wealthy people, most of the super wealthy, wealthy people do not indulge. They're not materialistic in that way. Very limited amount do they actually spend. Very limited. The percentage that they spend on whatever it is, on houses that they own, on cars that they own, on clothing that they own, is a fraction of what they have. The whole idea is to have it, which is why they can't spend it. To have it. And then they wind up dying, they die. That they can't stop. It would make a lot of sense, perhaps, if they were going to live forever. Then, okay, I could see something. But they're creating a situation which would make sense if they were going to live forever, and they act as though they just forget that little fact. They're building, these guys are in their 60s, 70s, they can't stop, they're building empires, empire builders, and they're so busy making money, they've overlooked one tiny little fact that's escaped their attention. What's that? They're not going to be here. It's over. The game is pretty much over. And from any perspective, as they meet, as they do deals, as they celebrate another big triumph, they're just that, how far are they from over, from death? That's that close. Well, you think this is crazy. What are you, nuts? Do something with your life. Enjoy it. Use the money for something. You're going. And they forget. They forget that fact. So all of their time is consumed with acquiring bread, basically. And it was much, much more than you ever needed. It's an absurdity. It's bad to have less than you need, that's true. But it's just as bad to have more than you need. Not bad to have it. If you have it, you have it. Doesn't matter. I'm saying to the consequences. The amount of energy, the expenditure, the anxiety, the waste of time. You wasted your time. You didn't have to work. You could have done something that makes sense for a human being. Given that a human being is a higher being and the essential element is the soul, and that is supposed to be perfected and elevated, and it needs time, and you had the time, you had the opportunity. You could sit and learn and study. You could have access to all the wisdoms, and that you didn't do because you were fixated on getting things that you don't need, you have no need for, except for the fact that it's your ego. Well, it's an ego need. That is the teaching of the mind. That it's a fundamental principle of Torah that God constructed man for a purpose, but he put him in an environment in which he has needs. He has to secure those needs, and people make a huge mistake. And they think that they're caught up in the struggle for survival makes it impossible for them to deal with their true metaphysical need. But the teaching of the Torah, the Rambam expands on this idea in the Morne Nevuchim. It's one of the most powerful chapters, one of the most significant, and it's one which you don't have to be. There are many areas in the Morne which he wrote in a way which you really can't understand unless you're on a certain very elevated level and ready for metaphysical ideas. This is one that a person can readily understand. And you should read it over a number of times, as all the chapters. It's called On the Evils, the different evils. He really deals with the problem of evil in the world. It's an amazing chapter. Theology has always been challenged by the so-called problem. Is there such a thing as evil? Everybody seems to be convinced that it is. But you read this chapter of the Rambam and you will learn a totally different approach towards the issue of evil. My understanding is that if you want to call it addiction or you want to call it attachment, I'm not making such a big difference between the two. When a person becomes attached to something, let's say it's a friendship. You really like this friend. And you really enjoy the friend. And you get together every week, and it's a very important thing. I think most people would say, assuming that the friend is not a bad influence on you, assuming it's positive, that's a good thing, and you're really thankful. Because even if it's not a necessity in terms of the food being a necessity, obviously, or shelter, but it's a psychological necessity. You can't take that attitude that, well, that's just an emotional need. So, we're emotional beings. A person needs friends all of his life, as the Rambam says, because we're social animals. If a person would try to live his life in a purely ascetic fashion, according to the Rambam, and not have friends, not have any, just eat the minimum food, not have any enjoyments, not have any emotional enjoyments, that person is a sinner. That's a sin. Because since you're a social being, you're a psychological being, if you're going to be experiencing deprivations in that area that are beyond what a person, you're going to be suffering, and you will not be able to serve God. I think the way we're constructed, given that when we enjoy certain things, we want more of those things, and then we make attachments, we have friends. And once you have friends, you do become vulnerable. There's vulnerabilities in life. That is, if you can't be with that person, then you're going to suffer a certain amount of pain. You're going to be lonely. If something happens to that person, you're going to be upset. That's part of the scheme of things. Then why have children? That's an addiction. You're going to become attached to your children, obviously. That's a huge one. You suffer. You know how much suffering you're going to have? I don't mean to put it in a bad way, but that's a reality. Because you have children, and that's a great significance to you. It's great anxiety if your children are not doing well, or if you have problems with your children. It's very, very satisfying if it goes well. But it's a huge risk. It's a risk. If you want to look at it purely technically, without any kind of emotion, every parent will tell you it's not what you think it is. When you don't have children, you can't imagine, oh, you just see so cute, and it's the most wonderful thing in the world. Because all you see is a few limited things. You don't see all the difficulties. It's called Tsar Gidel Banim, the pain of raising children. Any parent will tell you, even parents that are happy and things work out well, will tell you there's tremendous amount of stress and anxiety. And psychological suffering, it's probably the most painful thing for an individual. I think it's easier for a person to take personal pain rather than to see their children suffering. I think that's harder for a person. Nevertheless, I don't think anyone's going to suggest, a person could make the suggestion that don't have children. Is it rational to have children? That's a good question. I could see someone who's approaching from a purely practical, pragmatic, rational viewpoint saying the pleasure does not outweigh the pain. And there are people, by the way, that deliberately do not have children. Most people do have children. I don't know that they do so because they've thought it through rationally and they've come to the conclusion that it makes more sense. I think most people do it for an emotional reason. They feel emptiness. They feel a tremendous emptiness in their lives. And they need to feel a certain importance to their lives, which they can't feel about just themselves personally. And they need something. And having someone, it's like a noble thing, having a child. It's also ego. Most people are disappointed in life. They didn't become what they wanted to, so the children will. It's a combination of factors, and there's also the factor that there's a certain importance and your life is over, but your children continue. Well, it's a combination of those things. It's not because of rationality. Those people who don't partake of those... Now, the Torah maintains one does it as a service of God, which is the only rational reason. We do it as a service of God. We don't do it because it's a pleasure thing. That's a misnomer. A person that's having children because they want to have children, they're all excited, it's a baby, that kind of thing... They're doing it purely as an emotional thing. As an emotional thing, I don't know if it makes sense. I warn those people, you're going to be very disappointed. You might be very disappointed. Certainly a rationalist, someone who does not have that emotional need, someone who doesn't have the feeling that his life is empty, he's quite content to live his own life, does not feel that his life is empty, does not feel the bad that he has no importance and he needs to have a child to make him fall important, does not have that problem, and does not have this need to experience some type of immortality. If you remove those things, and this person is living a life which they're happy, have a healthy ego, they're doing something significant, they will come to the conclusion not to have children because they'll view the children as an impediment. It takes a tremendous... It's a selfless phenomenon in that way, anyways. I mean, deep down, it's selfish, but I'm saying, at least in the immediate level, you're going to give up on the things you want to do in life. Someone who is going about it without these emotional needs, and then would be looking at, then you'd have to look at it, well, is it a matter of justice? Do I have an obligation, a responsibility, and so on? And according to the Torah, it's interesting, it's a mitzvah to have a child. You do it because of the mitzvah, you're serving God. And the reason for doing it should not be as a means of gratifying your own personal things. But you see, from all of these standpoints, once you do that, you are creating vulnerabilities for yourself because you become attached to that situation. And it's a great area of human suffering and misery has to do with children. Simply because your responsibility, you feel tremendously responsible, and it's probably one of the most painful things, these parents that go through the sufferings of the children because the children don't, so to speak, turn out right, or they're not successful, or they're failures, or they break the law, or whatever it is. You read about that all the time. It's got to be the most excruciating pain in the world to have to experience the sufferings of your children, in whatever case, or the failures, and so on. But nevertheless, I don't think a person that's part of life. We were designed that way. Man is structured in such a way that he has certain needs, and when he gratifies those needs, he develops certain attachments, and once he develops attachments, he it becomes vulnerable. And to simply avoid all the situations of life because they make me vulnerable, that would be kind of, that's not a philosophy of life. You can't live your life that way. So therefore, that too is part of the perfection of man, that he learns how to deal with disappointments. There's no such thing as a life that doesn't contain disappointments. An intelligent individual gears himself, tries as best as he can to invest his energies in areas where the profit margin is great and the risks are less. That's why we say that learning is the greatest activity. Because it's something which becomes yours and you have control over it and you're not dependent upon others. Other activities, person gets as high in life, so to speak, out of skiing, is not fortunate as a person who gets as high, so to speak, out of learning. And not to mention the difference, the qualitative difference of the enjoyment of learning. There's no experience like it because man was designed for it. That is the greatest experience. Person that works through and gains insight and understanding of the universe, the happiness that provides, in my opinion, cannot be matched by other things. But even if they could, but look at all of the liabilities with skiing. The expense, the dangers, you can't do it constantly till you get out there. And then you have to schlep up to the top of the mountain until you get it right, and you didn't get it right, and you fell, and you got... That's not, and then, you know, as you get older, it may become more difficult if you get injured. For all these reasons, you cannot compare it. The person that has learning, he wakes up in the morning, how much does he need? He has his cup of coffee and whatever else. He takes out his safer and he's learning already. He's having fun. He doesn't need anyone. If he has a friend to learn with, to analyze with, fine. And if, for example, that's easy to acquire. If you derive a tremendous enjoyment, it takes up the social too, because you teach others. Or you'll say, but I'm dependent. It's not that hard to find students. So you just you get some students, you give a class, and that enhances the learning. It's a whole different experience. So it's true that once you do these things, they become very important to you, and if you didn't have them, but it's a good investment. It's a good addiction because it's healthy, it's beneficial, it leads to a higher level. And it's there. You're not investing in something which is so risky. God knows you could lose everything. No. So we have to. We have to become attached. A wise person deals with his emotions too. A wise person protects himself even in friendships. A wise person knows that the friend can turn against me and so forth. And therefore you go about it in a certain way. And you don't put all of your energy into something. And true. But even with wisdom and everything, if you have suitable friends and stuff, you're going to have disappointment. You cannot protect yourself from that. That's life. A person that would withdraw from everything because of that would be an escapist. He's escaping from life. According to the Torah, he's not living correctly. So that's part of the game. One should think intelligently, invest your energy intelligently, and all of that. But it's an impossibility. You have to accept these are the terms of existence and that there's no way of life that's not the way we measure it. That's foolproof in the sense that it doesn't lead to failures, to disappointments, and so on and so forth. So that, therefore, I don't look at it that way. I don't have this idea that you become addicted to that. And therefore you give it up. That's not the case. You have to look at the factors and weigh it, whether it makes sense to give it up. Maybe it doesn't make sense to give it up because maybe you're getting a certain enjoyment out of it. And you need that enjoyment. And if you don't have the enjoyment, you'll feel grumpy. But so what? Maybe, take coffee for example. It's something which I'm not worried about. We've never had a real coffee shortage. We've never had a problem with that. And again, if it should be the case, so for a few days you'll withdraw and then you'll be fine. It's not going to devastate you. And so on. I mean, these things have to be measured that way. Obviously, if you're talking about an addiction to something like smoking, you have to look at it differently because it does contain the health issue. So there's a health issue over there and one has to factor that in. How much? Is it that much that it's really... I know that today it's very difficult to discuss it because, again, it's become a fanaticism. Those who are opposed are fanatically opposed, and they'll say any amount. If you take one puff in 5 years, then already that's crazy. But that's not a rational approach. Today, many people get involved in causes and they become fanatics about it. The environment. Fair, you know, the thing with ethical treatment of animals.
Yeah.
Everything else, it becomes a fanaticism and they could commit any crime. People don't matter. They can commit any crime for the sake of their cause. That's just a crazy fanaticism. A zealousness. That doesn't make sense. But in terms of things that make sense, you have to evaluate it. Obviously, you're talking about drugs. You shouldn't do drugs. Because that's not the kind of thing that a person really needs. That takes a person out of reality. And that's very, very addictive. And nothing but danger. So there's no benefit and there's tremendous harm. So that's something that a person should avoid. In terms of other things, we'll return to this theme. Luxuries, that's a good question. Should I, if I have an opportunity, should I do something or buy something which is a luxury? And that seems to be going a little bit contrary to the philosophy of Judaism, that a person should live their lives in accordance with necessity and not go for the luxuries, which apparently you don't need. Do I need a mink coat? I can have a regular down jacket which keeps me warm. And it's much cheaper. So should I pursue all this fashion? I can get a pocketbook. I need a pocketbook. I don't need one. You do. But a pocketbook, you can get one that's reasonable. And it doesn't have the fancy designer shtick and all of that. Or should I get this one? It's a Gucci. Or it's a Louis Vuitton. Which means that it costs about 35 times more than the average one because of the name. But you got to have it. Should you do that? Is there a principle of moderation over there as well? How do I evaluate things like that? When you like something, a certain type of car, a certain type of clothing, a certain type of thing, which is pretty much out of your league, but you like it, and let's assume you'll save money and you can get it. I mean, should I pursue that? I assume it's not really a necessity. I can do it with a plain car. I don't have to get the fancy car. But let's say I can. Let's say I could afford it. And I like it. Those things are a little bit more complex to deal with. And we'll need some more time to think. I'll let you think about that. But there are certain people that really are scrupulous. They just want to live with moderation. They don't want to get the fancy things. Because that's not really needed. I don't need fancy. I would say this is just the beginning. It's an opener. It's just a suggestion. And we'll leave on that note. We'll come back to the topic. One distinction that a person ought to make is, in this situation, consequences. There are certain things that when you get them, it's not just that thing, but it's bringing you into a whole different realm now. There's a lot of other things that go with it. If I get that, then I have to get the other thing and the other thing. It's putting you into a different... It's sort of like changing your level. It's putting you into a different category. That's the way most people work. Most people want to go from categories. They're striving to get to the next level. And to the next level means you have to have like two homes. You have to have the winter vacation. You have to have this. You have to... It's a package. And then once you get used to that, because you get used to it very quickly, then you got to strive to the next level. So I would differentiate. Is it a different level? Or no, sometimes it's that one particular object. A person may have certain things you enjoy. You may enjoy photography. Somebody may enjoy skiing. So you can get the fancier thing or the better thing, whatever it is, top of the line. You'll really enjoy it. If it's something which has a use, you'll really enjoy it. You're not doing it because I want to be fancy, because I want to have that name brand. I really enjoy it. That's one thing. And two, it's an isolated thing. It's not opening up a whole new way of life. That is, oh, so now I have to have a designer wardrobe. It's going to affect every aspect of my life. Then I'm moving into designer from ordinary. If it's something which is pervasive and means changing your lifestyle, then I really seriously question it. But if it's not, if it's an isolated thing, it's an indulgence. It's an indulgence. But you have to look at your whole life. You're not living a life of indulgence. Just because you partake of an indulgence does not mean that you're living a life of indulgence. The principle of your life is not based upon indulgence. The principle is based upon firm principles. You're living an intelligent life, pursuing proper goals, proper ideals. And you have an opportunity to have something which is an indulgence. But you're not doing it because you want the ego to be gratified. You really would enjoy it. An opportunity came along to go on this cruise, and for whatever reason, you would always like to go on a cruise. It's an indulgence, but the opportunity came along. It's a one-time kind of a thing. It's not going to be becoming a habit. Or you want to purchase a certain type of whatever, a stereo system, which is really advanced, because you like the music and you get an enjoyment. So that's an indulgence. You can live without it. It's an indulgence, but it's a limited indulgence. It doesn't indicate that you become an indulgent person. You're just partaking of one particular thing. That, I think, would be a serious factor to consider. That would be one of the criteria I would use. That if it's not changing you into a different kind of person, of course, one can fool oneself, but just assuming it's not, though. Got to be careful. And you're partaking of something which would be an indulgence. But it's useful to you. It will provide a certain emotional benefit. And it's not going to turn your head. Your values will remain the same values. Then I would say that's okay. If, however, it's not, it's a reflection of the fact that it's an ego, you're changing. It indicates some kind of a change. That you don't want, you feel bad that you only, not that there's anything wrong with the clothing, but you want to upgrade. You sort of, it's an ego thing. Then it's a different, I would look at it differently. And again, I'm not saying what the outcome would be. I'm just giving you a general criteria. If it's something that presages a change in your lifestyle, it's going to be a little bit pervasive, because once you get this, then you have to get the other thing, and so on and so forth, and it's a whole different kind of lifestyle, then I would be a little bit more suspicious, because then you're going towards a lifestyle of moderation, towards one of indulgence. That's what you want to avoid. You want to avoid a change in the lifestyle. You want to keep your lifestyle in line with the principle of moderation, of necessity. Within reason. I mean, you can't measure these things. You can have a general sense. These things are changing all the time. Because what today is moderation, 50 years ago would have been tremendous indulgence. Any one of us today are tremendously indulgent. Every car today has air conditioning. 40, 50 years ago, it'd be very wealthy to have air conditioning in your car. Even air conditioning in your house. You had a fan. So today, all the basics, that's what happens. That's the way it's always expanding and expanding and expanding in the realm of the material. And so, look what kids have today. Just look at kids. What kids have today, the parents didn't have. Every kid pretty much has a car as soon as he's 18, but all the gadgets that he has, each kid has his own computer, has his own cell phone, is walking around his own cell phone. Kids have winter vacation. Kids partake today of more than the parents did years ago. And that's just the way it goes. So for the kid, that's no big deal. This is the starting point. All the things the kid has today is not a luxury. That's standard equipment. All the luxuries become standard equipment very quickly, and then you have to go further. That's the way it works. So you have to be careful about getting yourself into that kind of a psyche.